This is the State of Things, broadcasting from the American Tobacco Historic District. I'm Frank Stachow. In 2019, Raleigh police officers logged 519 incidents where they used force. There's a file on every single one of those incidents. In Raleigh, and in fact across the country, officers are required to submit a report every time they use their gun, taser, or tear gas. The report may include data and a narrative report. That way, a superior can keep tabs and follow up with an officer if there are any discrepancies or worrying patterns. But what if the public or a journalist wants to take a look at those files? Right now, a lot of folks want to keep an eye on their local sheriff or police department, and these use of force reports hold a lot of information about individual officers or the overall agency. To learn more about the effort, WUNC's data reporter Jason DeBruin is with me. Welcome back, Jason.
Frank, hi, good afternoon.
So in the midst of the early demonstrations in May, you and 10 other journalists with the NC Watchdog Reporting Network tried to take a look at those use of force files, and you came up empty-handed. What happened?
Yeah, I mean, you know, the short answer is just simply that they weren't given to us. You know, we filed the proper FOIA public records request report, and they were essentially denied. The little bit longer answer is that we contend that these are public records. Cities, counties, sheriff's offices, police departments contend that these are not public record because they are part of a personnel exemption in state law.
So the police are saying it's personnel, therefore private. You're arguing that this is something that happened by a public officer, a public employee, in a public space, and that needs to be made public. What information is available about that, within these reports?
Right. So there's aggregated data available from some departments. There has been an effort here recently, including by the FBI, to try to get a sense of the numbers of times that police officers use force. I think people may not be aware of how often this actually happens. I know we like to think of police officers as having to perhaps pull their gun only as absolute last resort, but it perhaps happens more often than people likely know. And so there just hasn't been historically a lot of data available on where, when, how, and why use of force is used among police officers. And so there's recently been an attempt to try to get a better understanding, but that is very recent. And again, you know, there's very little that we actually know. So you mentioned the 519 number from Raleigh Police Department. We've got some similar data from police departments across the state, but there's very little identifying information about who the police officer is, you know, who the victim is. I say victim, or, you know, who the force was used on, right. The citizen, you know, and all kinds of other information that just is simply kept out of the public's eye.
And when you use this personnel records as a shield against making this public, what other kinds of information can be declared personnel data?
So this is a big contention, not only in police departments, but really across city, state, you know, even federal government. There's a pretty common exemption, the personnel exemption, which isn't necessarily a bad thing, right? I mean, like cities keep the social security numbers or performance reviews of city employees and county employees. And that maybe shouldn't necessarily just be out there for the public to see. But what happens a lot of times is then cities and counties will take any kind of information that perhaps they don't want to have public and put it in the, you know, quote unquote personnel file. And then just simply because it's housed there, will claim the personnel exemption for all kinds of information. And this is sort of an ongoing fight between the public and clearly journalists and government actors, where we say, hey, we think this is a public record, this should be public, and the answer comes back, well, it's personnel, so it's a personnel exemption.
Yeah, but it feeds into this argument about and concern about the so-called wandering officer, somebody who has trouble in one jurisdiction and then just moves on to another jurisdiction, and nobody at that other city or town has access to their record.
Indeed. Now, certainly you would hope that chiefs and lieutenants would be mindful and make proper hiring decisions. But at the end of the day, the answer is we just simply don't know because, again, yeah, this is, we're just not seeing these reports.
All right. So each law enforcement agency can treat use of force reports differently, right? You had the Watchdog Reporting Network requested reports from 18 of the state's largest law enforcement agencies. What data were you able to track down?
Again, very little. We did get some aggregated data, as I mentioned, and so that's, you know, a start where at least you can get a high level understanding of, I guess, department wide information. But yeah, frankly, we got just very little information, and certainly didn't get anything. Not even the report. Like in some cases, you might get a record where some information is redacted, right? But we didn't even get that. We didn't even get anything at all. So, I mean, I hate for that to be the whole story right now, but simply that kind of is the story, is that we think that there's information here that we're not getting, and we're just not getting it.
Well, how much of this protection is state law, local ordinance, policy? Where would it, you know, if you wanted to address this, at what level do you address it?
Yeah, that's a good question. So it's state law. The public records law actually in North Carolina is pretty broad. It starts from the position that literally everything is a public record. Now, over years, there have been several exemptions that have been added into the law. But I think it is important to note that the onus is on city governments, or the onus is on government, to explain why something is withheld. The onus is not on the citizen or the journalist to explain why something should be a public record. So that's a good start. I mean, I think that's a good place to begin from. But over the years, there have been these exemptions added in. And we talked to a lot of experts, public records experts, and they said that as soon as an exemption is put in, it's very difficult to have that exemption repealed. In fact, I was speaking with somebody from Elon, and he was saying he really couldn't even think of any significant example where after an exemption was put on the public records law, that it was at some point later then repealed. So it just doesn't happen very often.
Well, and with so many local agencies and so much discretion, the state government does want to take a more active role. I know you spoke with Attorney General Josh Stein about exactly how much data the state wants to release to the public.
If the chief or the mayor were of the mind that there was something in the report or that would be of some value to the public, to have trust in what happened, then they have that ability under the current state law to release it. I mean, one thing that we could do is certainly anonymize the report so that we can look at an agency level. If we aggregate all of the reports without saying which officer it was that had the use of force, we could have better information as to what's happening in a particular city by a department as it relates to use of force.
That's Attorney General Josh Stein talking about use of force reports, which law enforcement agencies currently make confidential. WNC data reporter Jason DeBruin is my guest now. So how much of that would satisfy activists, the fact that there is some political oversight? A mayor has access to this, apparently, the police chief. Would that be enough to satisfy the demands of activists who say, look, when we think it's appropriate, you need to show us this?
Well, it would certainly be a start, right? And especially if even the names of the officers were redacted, but you would get more information about the actual incident, that would certainly be a start. Clearly, I think there are some people who probably wouldn't be satisfied until the whole entire report were turned over. But at least from our perspective, obviously, it would be a good amount of information where you would at least get details about each individual incident as opposed to just this, you know, large scale aggregated data. And it's perhaps worth pointing out that we did offer this as an option to police departments where we said, you know, feel free to redact some information, you know, and we even offered, you know, take out the officer's name so that, you know, that sort of, I guess, negates, you might say, that personnel aspect of the exemption being claimed. But yeah, that was also denied.
Well, I want to quickly turn to another issue, this issue of funding. The city of Raleigh denied the police department's request, or the city council, for increased funding. That happened in Raleigh. But in Durham, the city council unanimously approved a budget increase for the police, and that has stirred quite a controversy. Talk about these two decisions in these two different jurisdictions and how it all played out.
Right. And maybe it's even worth adding on top of that, that the Wake County Sheriff's Office actually saw a budget decrease from compared to what they had last year. I think it's worth pointing out that, you know, this activism began very recently, right? So about May 30th is when, especially North Carolina, where a lot of this came to a head. Certainly the impact of COVID-19 on local budgets is not to be minimized. And so where, especially in Raleigh and Wake County, where budgets are being either held flat or even decreased, that's not necessarily a direct line to the defund the police movement. Certainly the coronavirus did also played an impact. But as you mentioned, yeah, in Durham, the budget was actually increased. And that's something that has some protesters angry. I think they're even camping out in front of the police department, even currently, to try to get some of that changed.
Well, what's interesting is you said the protest began in May, but what we have said a couple of times on this show, and it's obviously been reported elsewhere, that in Durham there has been long-term conversations about ways to rethink the idea of public safety and refund the way government or the way police agencies work. These conversations have been going on for several years, and it does. And you know, and Durham was held up as the shining light on the hill when it came to police reaction to demonstrations, and then this, which has caused quite a controversy. I mean, it is an interesting thing to point out in this moment.
No, it's without question. I used to say years. I might even contend decades. The relationship between Durham police and Durham citizens has not always been the shining light on the hill, as you mentioned. Though recently, I think even activists would say that things have gotten better. But clearly, many activists are calling for a shift in funding away from police officers and towards social work. You know, food programs, hunger programs, poverty programs, the very things that end up causing crime. And so if there's a way to fund programs that help people prevent crime in the first place, isn't that what policing should be all about anyways, right? And so, yeah, there certainly is a push for that in Durham and statewide.
Jason DeBruin, WNC data reporter and a fellow for Guns and America. Jason, thank you so much.
You're welcome.
You can, his work, by the way, is part of the NC Watchdog Reporting Network, and you can find out all of that at our website, stateofthings.org.